To me, the X-Men became about, it was actually about adults versus children, because I felt that the whole thrust of the X-Men was actually about the generational thing, that people dislike their children because new ways of looking at things, and adults kind of don't like that because it's threatening to them. So I saw the X-Men as being about that, and basically that's where we took it, in that direction. Basically about the war between adults and youth.
I don't look at me.
I'm looking at you.
You got yourself into that.
I'm looking at you for validation, Stan. It's all I want.
Welcome to E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, and we are your hosts. I'm Perry.
Hey guys, it's Oscar here.
This is Pat.
How you guys doing today?
I'm good. Getting back into the swing of things. Had a really good session at yoga today. I'm feeling pumped to speak to you guys. It's been a while now. We've had a bit of a break.
Yeah, it's been about a month or so, I think. Mm-hmm. Pat, how about you? How are you doing?
Not too bad. Just plugging along my day job, reading comics. Nothing too exciting.
Yeah, pretty much the same. I've been I got a new baby now. My son was born yesterday, as we were talking about off mic, and now I'm just half watching you guys on the Zoom screen and half watching my daughter over here to make sure she doesn't tear anything up.
Congratulations on the safe arrival of the second one, mate.
Thank you. Yeah, mm-hmm. Now we got a complete set, so we can stop. I can go get snipped now.
Excellent.
I've got some friends that have had the snip, and they say that it's relatively pretty painless. So
yeah. My dad had it done too a while back. So here in Japan, they've got some strict requirements because of the depopulation problem. So like you have to be like above 35. You have to have, I think you have to be married even too. I think you have to, basically say that you're absolutely committed, that you're done having kids and all this kind of stuff. Huh. I think you have to get the spouse permission too, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Well, because they got a depopulation problem here, so they're hoping for more accidents.
Well, I just find that blows my mind that you'd have to ask, you'd have to get somebody else's permission to do something to your own body.
Oh, it's the same thing with abortion here. Like you have to have the consent of the father. Although they don't do any DNA tests or anything, so like you could just
get someone else to say.
You just get someone else to sign it. Yeah, basically.
Yeah. It's a nice little go around. Oh, crazy, crazy, crazy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's the final episode of the show. Now that we finished the read through, we tried to see if we could get in touch with some of the creators, but no luck there, it seems. So we're just going to be pretty much closing up shop and kind of talking about the legacy of this run. And Oscar even took one for the team.
Yeah.
Reading
kudos, yeah. Friend.
He emails us yesterday and he says, he's like, I went and I read the Chuck Austin issues. I'm like, we weren't planning to read those, were we?
Yeah, my bad. And I'm glad that I did it anyway, just for I did it for research purposes only. Like obviously I wouldn't be going and reading those books for pleasure, but as bad as you could remember.
Mm-hmm.
And there are obviously just like two issues of filler while they did a line one relaunch after, but you think if you've got the opportunity to do two issues of a filler with such rich characters, you would choose to do something, anything better than what he did. It was awful.
As I recall, and I never read these issues, but I just remember people talking about them back when they came out. it was just basically kind of retreading the whole Scott Emma thing for most of it, which was pretty much resolved at the end of Morrison's last issue.
Yep, that's exactly it. And it could have been two, and it's like, oh, humans hate mutants, and they start to riot and throw Molotov cocktails into a building. So you really need the X-Men there for that, but whatever. They skate around the Scott and Emma thing. It could have just been a really good opportunity for them to go deep into Scott or deep into Emma's decision, or even for Scott to take a moment to think that Jean's dead. Like, it's barely even mentioned that Jean is dead, and it just seems like crazy. I don't know what they were thinking, or even if they really cared.
I think they just had that space, that gap in the schedule, and they just had to fill it, is what I'm thinking. It's the only thing that it makes any sense.
Yeah, but you could fill it with something cool. Like, I think when I think of the coolest filler issues, I think of, like, you know, Kitty in the Mansion with the, you know, they could have done something really cool like that. It almost like tarnishes the reputation, the rest of the new X-Men legacy is what they did. That's how bad it was.
Right.
Even the art was bad.
It still even had the new X-Men branding on it.
Logo.
Yeah. It had the new X-Men branding, the new, and it was like, I can't even remember now. I don't have it here, but something like Bright New Day. And then the second issue was like, Night of Mourning or something like that. It was just so pathetic. It's so like pedestrian. It was really, really bad.
If anyone out there is thinking about, let's have a look.
Don't do it.
Where should we start with talking about the legacy of this run? Should we talk about the immediate aftermath? And you just kind of touched on the Austin issues that came right after, but right after this, you know, we had the basically a complete reset of most of the things, except for the only things that kind of stayed in put were Xavier leaving the mansion and Scott and Emma being together. And then everything else just kind of reset, basically.
And the students stayed around as well, right?
Yes, the students stayed around. The fact that the mansion is a school.
Okay, so yeah, like I was saying, this was kind of the era when they kind of had, you know, basically reset everything.
Yeah, but, you know, Scott and Emma stayed, like you were saying, that the concept of, I think, the mansion as a school, I think, became a mainstay for a really long time. And a lot of the kids stayed around, sort of continuing that tradition of you never graduate from the school, ever.
Well, with the kids that stuck around, I feel like... the Cuckoos definitely maintained a prominent spot, but I feel like the others, like Beak and Angel, were kind of pushed in the background, and we didn't really, even Quentin, you know, he didn't really come back into the fold until much later, right?
Well, he had that appearance in End Song, which I think not that long after the end of the run. And then a lot of the new kids got folded into aptly named New X-Men by, was it Christina Strain who wrote that initial run? I don't quite remember, but they had Dust and I think a lot of the other kids from that Morrison introduced.
That's the Academy, the beginning of Academy X?
Yeah, the Academy X books.
Right, because I remember it was... because originally it was whoever was doing that. Checking here.
There was two people. It was two co-writers, but their names escape me.
Well, there was Craig Kyle and Chris Yost, but they were the second iteration.
They came, later.
The first run, I think one of the writers was Christina Strain, but she had a co-writer.
I think she did Generation X, the second version of that.
I knew the initial run.
Christina Weir.
Writers. That's it.
That's
Christina Weir and Nunzio DeFilippis.
Right.
That's it.
They continued on from the New Mutants title that launched in the midst of Morrison's run, I believe, right?
Yes.
So yeah.
I think the editorial team had a big discussion when New X-Men finished and said, right, all the other books have to take on one element of this new X-Men, pick one thing. So they kind of all had like one character or one storyline that absorbed out of it, and it just dissipated everything.
Yeah, and it was a weird kind of thing because Uncanny X-Men, Claremont came back to that, and that was basically just a continuation of what he was doing at the end of Extreme X-Men with the whole XSE thing, and then and pretty much the exact same team with just Nightcrawler and Rachel added on. And then
but Perry, but also new costumes.
Yeah
don't you find that Rachel...
the new costumes
doesn't Rachel always get added in as soon as Jean Grey goes away,
pretty much? Yes, yeah.
and she has that petulant, like, I know this is a big thing when Claremont came back, like, it's Rachel Grey,
right
Rachel Summers.
She had to have this.
Because I hate you for being an adulterer, Dad. So it's Rachel Grey now.
Yeah, then, that was dumb.
That was dumb, yeah. And then we had over on Chuck Austin's book, which was New X-Men, then it reverted back to just X-Men. It was a weird just kind of shuffling around of stuff. And then they gave Josh Whedon his own book with Astonishing X-Men. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the core new X-Men team, they were basically handled by Whedon in Astonishing with the addition of mm-hmm. Kitty. And then...
and Colossus. Colossus,
yeah, later on. And then Claremont was basically just continuing his stuff in Uncanny. And then Austin basically got everybody else. How it basically worked out.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of impact, too, I think we should point out that was the longest time, I think, that Jean stayed dead.
Yeah, I believe so. I'm not sure how long it was originally, but that was what, like, at least almost 20 years, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think originally it was like 5 or 6 years. I think.
I'm checking the dates right now. You guys keep going. I'll check up on those.
Yeah, I think because she died in the Dark Phoenix saga. Mm-hmm. And then...
came back in Fantastic Four when they found her cocoon.
Yeah, but what it was like X Factor when the first X Factor came out, right?
Right, that's but she came out. Her cocoon was found out in the Fantastic Four
in that right, one right, issue. Right. But then the next month she was in X Factor.
X Factor, yep.
So that was the last issue of the Dark Phoenix saga was in 1980, and then Fantastic Four 286 is when she appeared. That was in 86, so about 6 years.
6 years, yep. So I think the streak broke that record by quite
a bit. Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah. It's funny when you think about it, because in retrospect, when we're thinking back on those days, because, you know, at least I know I wasn't reading comics back then. I was way too young. I'm not sure about you guys. But when you're looking back on those times, it feels like it was a lot longer back then, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And I think because this time, even though she was gone, like her presence was still very much in all the books. Like mm-hmm. she was just sort of this thing that, like, this absence that everyone was reacting to, like all the X-Men and sort of like Rachel, like renaming herself. And of course, like the endless, like, oh, that mean little Emma, like wasn't even cold on the ground and she's already moving. I mean, there was that scene in Astonishing, you know, with Logan, and he's like, you know, what stage of grieving is this? You know, like,
that was one of my favorite moments from that run.
It was great. It was great, though. It was great. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The image of him as well was drawn so well by Cassidy.
Oh, Cassidy was
yeah,
stellar on that artwork. I did love that. I did love some of those interactions. Like, you know, Josh Whedon is a, you know, he's a fucking bastard, but, you know, he wrote some really good moments in that.
I always find it really interesting. They have to do that. Scott moved on from Jean after she died, rather than being an overlap with those two relationships, which was in actuality what happened. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe sometimes they dumb things down a little bit, maybe for the audiences. Like, it's easier for kids to understand, oh, one started and the other started, instead of there being an overlap.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's something we've talked about with now Jean and Scott both coming back, and how we wish there was more of an overlap between with Jean and Scott both being alive but not being together.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. And I really wish that they took the opportunity to explore them both single, and both, especially Jean, with other people, not Scott or Logan.
Right, because we have seen Scott with other people, like during the first time Gene died, you know, there was obviously Madeline Pryor, but then him with Lee Forrester, there was that whole thing that went on.
I think Jean Grey has a little bit of like that, what is it? The Madonna Hall complex?
Yeah,
right?
Definitely.
Like, yes. The writers feel like she's too maternal, she's too nurturing. We can't have her being too much of a sexual being. She's allowed to have this sexual desire for Logan, but she's never really allowed to act on it.
There's better depiction of that in the X-Men than Jean and Emma, right? I mean, that's pretty much exactly Madonna and Whore.
Yes. And I find it a little bit misogynistic. And
you know, although, like, I feel like they're letting
it's not very 2022.
No.
They'll get away with more stuff in the current, well, like with Logan, than they have before. I think.
Yeah, because they finally fucked.
Yes.
Spoiler
if anyone. Yeah.
I haven't gotten to it yet.
Although I don't know.
Well, read X-Force and you'll see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, I guess she came back briefly in End Song, but
that was the weird thing.
I'm
not
sure if we're counting that.
Well, they kept teasing her return a lot, right? So they had in Astonishing, even, right? They had that thing where, you know,
they had that big fake out because
right where
to,
B
like,
says finds out someone's DNA right. And he says like, oh, there's nothing stay buried, and then Scott and Scott, the issue ends on the cliffhanger Gene, and then it turns out no, it's actually Colossus.
Mm-hmm.
And then too, the like the End Song minis and the War Song and all that kind of mm-hmm. stuff, and then we had you know, Bendis, when he wrote it, he brought in the young Jean Grey and all this kind of stuff. So there's this weird, even though Jean was gone, I think that's why I think it feels like a bigger absence in the original after her original death, is because I feel like they
gone.
They weren't, yes. They didn't keep teasing her return. There's mm-hmm. like one storyline with
I'm
Mastermind.
I'm gonna push back on that a little bit. Push back on that a little bit, because for me, Madeline Pryor was all about Jean Grey. Right. So I don't think she was ever gone. They introduced Rachel not long after, with the Days of Future Past, and it's not long after that Rachel comes into the X-Men, and then they have Madeline Pryor running around and Scott marrying her, and everyone just being like, oh wow, you look exactly like his ex-wife, but we're just going to pretend that that's totally normal and cool.
Although, I mean, that was actually Claremont's original intent, was that she just happened to look just like Jean Grey. Mm-hmm. She wasn't going to be a clone or anything. And then later they decided to do the clone thing, which is still a really, I think it actually makes it worse that with that original plan, because it shows that it reflects really badly on Scott, basically implies that he only marries this woman because she looks like his ex.
Like, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think the difference is like in that original Dark Phoenix death, like I feel like most of the characters were with varying levels of success were like trying to move on from her death, whereas after New X-Men I feel like all of the characters were in this sort of denial phase, like they just can't accept that she's gone, and this
also
sort of this feeling of like it's inevitable, she's gonna come back, she's going to come back, we're just waiting.
They literally basically wrote it on the gravestone.
She will rise again. Yeah.
She will rise again. Yes.
You know,
there you go.
So it's like we mm-hmm. all knew that she was coming back. They were just like, oh, we're not going to pretend. We're just going
to. I think that's more what I'm getting at. Like, it's one thing to have Madeline and Rachel and these things that remind us of Jean. It's another thing to have these constant fake outs of Jean coming back, where, you know, we had the Phoenix miniseries. We had, you know, the young Jean Grey coming into the present, and she stuck around for like what, 10 years or something? It was a ridiculously long time.
And they even, I think they commissioned like maybe actual art from Cassaday for Astonishing, and like I think they leaked it or something to create the impression of like, oh it's Jean, but it wasn't Jean. And I think by the time New X-Men ended, I think at least me, a lot of comic readers have become kind of cynical and jaded about comic book deaths. Like, mm-hmm. I think when she died originally, there was this impression from comic readers that, oh, deaths are permanent. Like, it's going to stick.
Whereas
in the early 00s, it's sort of like, oh, well, Superman came back. So, like,
Well, I mean, especially
really gone.
I mean, because they undermined it themselves, because right after that run, they brought Magneto back. Colossus mm-hmm. comes back and mm-hmm. Psylocke comes back. All these other mm-hmm. characters are coming yep. back to life.
It's only a matter of time. So, yeah. Yeah.
And I think, too, that was also what jaded a lot of people, and just the constant teasing. So when we finally got to Phoenix Resurrection, it was just kind of like, I wondered when they were going to do that.
It's such a sense of like, oh, I guess it's just a formality, really, because, you know, it's going to happen. And I think it's also like the manner of her death, like whereas in Dark Phoenix, again, there's a sense of finality. But this exit feels a bit more like, well, she didn't really die. It's just more of an extended vacation mm-hmm. to the white hot room where she's going to hang out and do Phoenix-y things.
Well, especially because Morrison even brought her back in the future. So it suggests right. that if she could come yeah. back in the future, she could come back in the mm-hmm. present too.
She's in an egg. She's incubating. She's having a spa day. So
she's also died, remember, when the Sentinels attacked the Hellfire Club
mm-hmm.
and the Hellions were murdered. So she like died then as well. And they just came back 3 issues later.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remember that storyline where they were making comments about, oh, she's, you know, acquainted with dying and coming back. Mm-hmm. Her name's Phoenix.
Right.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
It's all kind of a moot point now, I think, with everything that's happening with the Krakoan Age and they're just bringing them all back.
But, and all that, yeah.
Yeah. But I remember we spoke about it on the very first podcast of what attracted us to the X-Men. And for me, it was that the characters died mm-hmm. and it gave them a sense of realism and tension within the scenes, because you're almost like Game of Thrones, right? Where your favorite character could die in any issue. Like when Colossus died, I remember that blowing me away. Such a great issue that was. But now that that's kind of, any sense of them really dying is completely dissipated from me as a reader.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they even brought back Thunderbird going really far back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like everyone now, and it's every character in the Marvel universe can be brought back except for Uncle Ben. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believe that eventually someone's going to do that as well.
Well, I mean, it used to be Uncle Ben, Bucky, and the Thunderbird were the only three characters that stayed dead in Marvel.
And Gwen.
And Gwen too. Yeah. And then,
yep.
Three of those four have come back with Gwen in an alternate universe form, but still.
Yeah, and Uncle Ben, it's only a matter of time.
I'm sure.
What did you guys feel about the immediate aftermath and then how Morrison's legacy kind of continued on after that initial reaction to it, I guess?
I think like Emma, for like, I feel like his Emma is the Emma that's like running around today. Like we can't have current Emma Frost without all the character work he did in that run. And by all accounts, like that's the version of the character that's stuck.
His version of Emma is the definitive one, right? Mm-hmm. It's the peak of any of her appearances.
And I think a lot of people too either don't know or aren't even aware, like, you know, she spent a lot of time with the X-Men and also Generation X. Like, I think a lot of readers will sort of feel like, oh, this is when she first showed up with the X-Folk.
I feel like I was thinking about what you were saying. I was thinking back to Generation X specifically. And that Emma, even though she still had a bit of the edge to her, she still felt like a much more kinder, gentler version. And then when you get to the Wood issues later on in the run, she got a lot harder. And I feel mm-hmm. like Morrison really did a good job of kind of blending those two aspects of her together, where she's got this deeper sense to her character, but she's also got this, you know, this hard outer shell.
Mm-hmm.
I recently just reread all of Generation X, and I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Like, she really is a bit, she starts off a bit hard, a bit White Queen teaching the Hellions ish, and she softens as the series goes through. and sort of deals with all that trauma and becomes very kind. And then when Wood takes on at the end of the series, she pulls back a bit and starts to become really hard and makes the key, you know, calls herself Auntie Emma, which I do love. Do love that. But I'm really grateful that she's become a mainstay in the X-Men, because I really liked her in Generation X as well.
I mean, I don't think, unless you have Morrison's run, like, Emma would never have become as prominent a presence as she became.
I don't think it's so.
Impossible. It wouldn't have happened. Do you guys remember pushback when he was first announced that she was going to join the team, and people like being no?
I don't remember any real pushback. I remember surprise more than anything. A lot of people just kind of like, oh, really, Emma? She seems like an odd choice. But I personally don't recall any real pushback to her on the team.
I think my initial reaction was two telepaths, actually three telepaths on the team seems a bit overkill. But I'm glad they let him do that now.
I think that was something else I remember people mentioning, that same thing, like having three telepaths on one team. Do you remember any blowback, Oscar? Because I can't recall any myself.
I can't remember really exactly, but I do remember people, when the team was announced, people being like, what the hell? What the hell? And out of all of the what the hell, it was more pushed on Emma. Obviously, as they started to read it, she became beloved. Mm-hmm. And definitely, I think anyone that's read the new X-Men series has a deep appreciation for the character of Emma Frost. It's impossible not to. It's the highlight of the series.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But yeah,
I don't think anyone would have anticipated that prior to the first release of this is going to be the new core team.
No, absolutely not. I think another thing that kind of surprised me after the run ended and that stuck around was Beast transformation, because that was another thing. There was a lot of hatred I remember about that. So I was expecting that to kind of be undone right away. And I was kind of surprised that it took up until Bendis before they had finally, and not really completely reversed it, but kind of like retooled it or something like that.
What do you guys think now? What's the best version of it? Of Beast?
I don't know. I kind of like his current form, because I always thought it was weird that he was ripping off Wolverine's hairstyle.
Like, do you mean from a visual aesthetic perspective, or like the way the character is being written, or both?
Visually.
I like the new X-Men. I guess I don't really have any strong feelings for Beast, but just from a purely visual perspective, I think the feline is my favorite.
I like the feline form when it's drawn by certain artists, but I also miss some of the, I feel like a lot of the athleticism he had in the more monkey form was kind of lost too. And that, and I did find myself missing that. Like the whole, you know, one of the few good moments out of X-Men The Last Stand is when we first see Beast and he's, you know, hanging upside down in his office.
I just felt like when we hit the Bendis era, there's some, I think, inconsistency between like the things that he's saying and the way that he's being visually depicted. Like, you know, there was a big thing about, oh, I'm mutating even more and I look like something else now. But the way that he's visually depicted looks just like pre-Morrison Beast.
Right, just without the hairstyle,
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
I did think that was
kind of head.
That was a weird kind of thing, is like they kept talking about how he's evolving still, when there didn't seem to be any indication of that at all.
Right, like you're kind of not, I mean, visually speaking.
But I think too, Beast was probably the least served as a character too in the years since, because I just read the Hellfire Gala and holy fucking shit, like what the hell is wrong with Beast?
It's not that Beast, it's Dark Beast.
That is like one of the weirdest things to me, because like it's such a swing between like, and I'm not sure if we're still talking about Morrison legacy stuff, but it's such a wide swing between like before the start of this era where you have like Beast being all like not like, you know, being angry at Scott and being angry at all the choices he's made, like pulling the O5 back to the present to make him like course correct. Mm-hmm. And now his Beast is acting like Scott would have during the Bendis era.
And then some. I mean, yes. You know, Scott had a kill squad. He wasn't, you know, brainwashing world leaders.
Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really a lot of explanation to establish why is he acting this way?
I hope Oscar's right and it's Dark Beast, because that's just, you know, I miss the.
I think it has to be. I've seen an interview with Percy, who's writing him now at the moment. He's saying that Beast is sort of like the head of the CIA, and the CIA does all of these really gross, awful things to keep their empire safe.
Oh God! If you want, this is a digression, but there's a really good book called Legacy of Ashes, and it's all about the CIA's action from like the Cold War up through the Obama years, and it's fucked up. It's really fucked up.
Yeah, you just look at like what the NSA have been doing to the population and stuff like that. And the idea behind it is, look, you know, someone has to do all these things to keep everybody free and safe. And I feel like that was the idea that he's going in, that Beast is sort of like, you know what, I'm going to take one for the team and do this. But when it just reads like Dark Beast, like he's the wrong character to sort of take on that.
If you're gonna do that with a character, I mean, do that with like Pete Wisdom or something, or Bishop,
or Forge, or yeah, just not Happy Go Lucky Henry McCoy.
Yeah, there's better character choices.
Yeah, I miss the old things. I miss the fun loving Beast. I miss the, you know, the jovial joking around Beast. I wish we'd get him back.
Yeah, I think we will. I'd bet the farm that they're going to have the Dark Beast be revealed when they pull the curtain back.
I mean, I guess technically, if in the way that they explain the resurrection protocol, like he's in the database, so he's a Dark Beast.
Sinister is probably meddled with it to bring him. Yeah.
What do you guys think about how Magneto has been handled in the years since? Because I think he's another character who kind of went on a bit of a roller coaster after this run.
We reread Planet X, and like, I don't know. Like, I feel like by that point, Morrison has just been using the character to make a point about superhero marquee comics. And, you know, a lot of the things that occurred in the run just sort of got immediately erased, which, given how he was used by Morrison in Planet X, I'm kind of happy with.
Oscar, how do you feel about it?
I remember being really upset when I read the first two or three issues of the Excalibur run that started after New X-Men folded, and you know, it was revealed, you know, 1 month after this had all happened, that it was a fake out and it wasn't really Magneto that Wolverine killed. And I just felt like really cheated, because I thought it took away from the Planet X story, and it was just really cheap way to.
Well, I mean, even to this day, that the explanation doesn't really make sense, because it was Zorn posing as Magneto, posing as Zorn, somehow he was able to make himself look like Magneto too. And it's just like all these leaps in logic you have to do to kind of make it make sense. And I feel like nobody's really tried to. They tease different things, right? Like there was this whole tease about how maybe it was Scarlet Witch messing with reality and she resurrected Magneto or something like that. But like nothing was ever really said definitively about that.
I just sort of accept that there's this blippy thing that happened. We thought Magneto was dead and now he's not. And I'm just not going to think too much about how that logic works, because it's very convoluted and gives me a headache.
That's what I was going to say. I think it's obviously editorially mandated. Yeah. Like, No, we're not going to do this anymore. We were going along with it because Morrison was in the helm of the core title. He's not here anymore. F you, Morrison, because of the way you left. We're just going to pretend that everything you've done isn't really important, and we'll just move forward because the character of Magneto is too valuable to the franchise to go with what you want him to do. So we'll just brush over it, and people will just accept it. And guess what? That's what we did.
Yep. And given his portrayal in Planet X, I think that might be the correctest. Like, that was not a good way for him to go out, if that was him going out.
Yeah, I agree to a point. I do agree that, you know, that's not the best way for Magneto to go out. I think it was a good idea to bring him back. But I think the way they went about it was really fucking terrible. And I think they could have... Mm-hmm. They could have come up with something much better if they just gave it 10 minutes of thought, and they didn't even do that much.
Although the ironic thing might be is that what we got probably took them 2 hours or more of thinking. defining the flow chart to like, how is this whole thing going to work?
I mean, was there a flow chart? Because it just kind of seemed like, you know.
No, there was. It was like a circular, concentric circles. Like,
was it like a circle that's drawn in crayon with your whole fist or something?
Yes, going round and round and round.
Because it was like the collective man, right? Wasn't it something about the collective?
That's
another layer of
the collective. Yes. Yeah, the collective man is a different character.
It's a different thing.
But he was connected in some way, though, right?
Not the collective. So there are two different concepts you're kind of merging together. The collective man is a Chinese superhero who can split himself up into like it's like kind of like a multiple man type thing, but it's based on like how many people there are in China or so. It was weird.
So wasn't this the Bend?
What you're talking about is called the collective, no man, just the collective. Okay. Yeah. All right. So I just wanted to clarify. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Perfect.
Where it was like because when Wanda said no more mutants, all that mutant energy that was pulled out of the mutants was like lingering around the atmosphere, and it kind of merged together, and Zorn's personality kind of became dominant. And then it went into Michael Poynter's body, and it was this whole thing.
Bendis did. I really, really enjoyed Alias when Bendis wrote that.
Alias was brilliant. Alias, so Daredevil, good. Ultimate Spider-Man, amazing work. And then
it made me realize, like, you know, he was a real talent, and I could see why Marvel loved him, because of the ones that you've mentioned, I only read Alias, and I really loved it.
His Daredevil, everything else Spider-Man he's are really done good is too. Yeah.
Awful. His X-Men stuff has been awful. It's wordy, really repetitive, and some of the concepts are just stupid and overly confusing.
He does well, I think, with the street level characters.
Yes.
Like when they put him on like the team books or like the cosmic stuff, like. No, thank you.
I mean, he did. I'm not sure if you guys have read any of his DC stuff, but his I read his first, I think the first two Young Justice books, those were pretty fun. And his Superman stuff was, it was okay. Like he had a good handle on Superman, he had a good handle on Clark Kent, he had a good handle on Lois, he had a good handle on all the characters, but the stories just didn't quite work. And then when he got into the whole, you know, I think he's got this lazy shtick of let's just reveal the character's identity. And then he did that with Superman, which is like the last thing you should ever do with Superman, but that's another story. And now DC's kind of stuck with that until they do another crisis or whatever. So we'll see how long that lasts. But yeah, I think I agree with you. I think I don't understand why Marvel never gave him a Heroes for Hire book, because like him doing you know, Luke Cage and Iron Fist and, you know, maybe Jessica Jones in there too, and like set in the street level, and that would have been fucking awesome. But
didn't he do a Defenders book
when he did a Defenders book? Yeah. I didn't read that, but yeah, he did a Defenders book with those three and
with that cast. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't read that, so I'm not sure how that was, but I mean, just like a straight Heroes for Hire book, like Luke Cage. And it's so clear he wanted to write that because he kept putting Luke Cage in every fucking book he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I think he could have done a really good in terms of the X-Men. He might have done a really good X-Factor. Like a street level investigating kind of book.
Oh yeah. Maybe. Like if you gave it, or like District X or something like that. Like him doing like Bishop as like a beat cop or something like that. Something like that would have been really good. But they kept putting him on these big name hero teams like Avengers and Guardians of the Galaxy. And his X-Men, I think it was better than his Avengers stuff. I will say that, but it definitely.
I really enjoyed the start of his new Avengers. I thought it was a really cool idea to make the Avengers like the Marvel version of
Justice League.
Yeah. And just having the biggest stars of Marvel all on one team. Like that was
I agree with the idea of that, but it didn't feel like it really was. Because you had concept. I mean, you had Cap, Wolverine, Iron Man, and Spider-Man. Okay. But then you had Luke Cage and Spider-Woman, who weren't really big name characters. Mm. Or the Sentry,
yeah,
too,
but
so I feel
Luke Cage kind of deserves it, and I think so does Spider-Woman. Like I thought she was cool to be there.
I'd say Spider-Woman definitely, she was huge. But with Luke Cage, I feel like it takes, same thing with Spider-Man, I feel it detracts from their characters when they're on the Avengers. I feel they work better in the street settings. Not saying that they're not characters who deserve to be Avengers, but just I feel like it takes more away from their characters than it adds.
I'm not gonna disagree with that. I just liked seeing all the marquee characters together. And I think that was quite a novel and good idea. If we were gonna do a marquee characters of the X-Men, who would they be?
Depends on who you talk to.
That's exactly what I was gonna say. Yeah, it's it's tough to have like a core X-Men, more like Justice League, Fantastic Four, it's very easy. You've got those core characters that are always part of every team. Mm-hmm. But the Avengers and the X-Men are a little bit harder. The X-Men even more so, right? Because you've had different eras defined by completely different casts. So for some people, it's Cyclops and Jean always have to be there. For some people, Storm and Wolverine and Colossus always have to be there. And, you know, for like, people who grew up in the 80s, you know, Kitty Pryde has to be there. For people who grew up in the 90s, we don't care about Kitty Pryde or Nightcrawler, but you know, Jubilee and Gambit have to be there. So there's been so many different iterations of the X-Men that I think it's really hard to kind of find out what is the definitive X-Men team.
For me, it's the animated series team.
I think a lot of people are drawn to that team that was around when they first started reading it. I came in with the animated series, but I started reading, I got so obsessed with the X-Men that I started reading so much other stuff while I was watching the series that I don't know who I choose for a definitive team myself. Patrick, what about you? Do you have any thoughts about any of that?
It's just, well, surprising absolutely no one. Patrick would like Emma on any team. There is. But honestly, beyond that, anything's negotiable because I guess it depends on my mood. Like sometimes you're just in an Australian team mood. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're like, I feel like blue and gold today. Like, and I think it's something to be said about the strength of the franchise where like there's just so many characters. And I feel like no matter who they put on there, it seems like it would sell enough to keep doing it, which is something to be said about
this batch of books. Having Claremont all the on the books for so long, I think is one of the reasons why, because he got bored with using the same character, so he kept switching it up. Yep. And then we had all these different spin-offs, so those characters got developed in different ways. So I think that's another reason why it's so hard. Whereas like with something like the Avengers, okay, yeah, you'll have, you know, Roger Stern come in and he'll use Monica Rambeau a lot, but then nobody else is going to touch her for years. Right. So it's like with the Avengers, it always felt like there's like, you know, like a core team of characters you use and then one or two pet characters that the writer throws in. Whereas the X-Men, it's just completely different.
Yeah, and I think a lot of fans too would say, like, yeah, there's the main X book, but really I'm more of a Generation X fan, or like X Factor is my speed. So even like within the franchise, I think a lot of fans would say, like, it's not even the core team that's like my team. Like,
especially really people who came up like in the 90s, like us.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, let's face it, the core X books weren't the greatest at the time they were being written.
Yeah, and you know, like, I think around like the mid 90s, like, there was this concept of like, there's the blue team and the gold team, and then that sort of started getting, or I guess not mattering as much. Mm-hmm. So there's really the sense of like, I guess lack of structure to it. Like, you know, all the characters just started bleeding into all of the books.
Yeah, how long did the separation of the blue and the gold team actually last? Like, not that long, maybe 2 years or something.
Yeah,
I think it really kind of ended when Nicieza left the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the point when it was kind of, because I know Mark Waid did it for a little bit, and that's when they started bleeding together. But mostly it was Scott Lobdell kind of doing both books, and it had basically become, there wasn't a whole lot of differentiation between the two books at that point.
And I mean, they didn't really have, I feel like, a solid mission statement. Like, there was no reason about, like, why is this a blue team and a gold team?
Yeah. That was one of the things that I liked that, like, I guess Claremont to a certain extent did this with his Revolution run, where he said that there was, you know, the book, the team in Uncanny, it's the globe-trotting team, the team in in the adjectiveless one, they're like the home base team. It didn't quite work out. Eventually those kind of blended together too.
Right.
But I think one of the strengths of the Morrison era was they really defined those differences between the teams, and they stuck to it. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that was a good thing that we had. You know, Morrison's team was the school team. The X-Men book was the away team. And then you had the Extreme X-Men, which was just, you know, Claremont winking off to his, you know, mind control fantasies.
And it made
I think the line works best when every title has a clear and defined mission statement, but also a clear and defined team.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it makes things too, like, you know, when Storm and the Extreme team show up, like, it's a special kind of novelty and excitement. Yeah. Like, like, these characters are going to interact, and what's that going to be like?
I also like they continue that too. You know, in the Reload era, you know, even though we've all got issues with it, they still had that, they were still continuing that approach. Whereas, you know, the Astonishing team was like the public face, the Extreme, the Uncanny team was the XSE team with their government connections. And then, I don't know, the X-Men team was whatever Chuck Austin was doing.
I'm not sure what that team was. It was something.
But still, like, even like, that's what I liked about the Extinction era too, where we had, you know, Mike Carey had Rogue Strike Team and all that kind of stuff. And and into the Schism era, where you had Kieran Gillen's team on Utopia, you had Aaron's team with the school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really loved that era too.
Do you ever think that Morrison would ever come back to Marvel?
I doubt it.
Well, I don't know. I guess
it depends on how much money they throw.
Well, I think it's also because, you know, things have changed a lot, because the people he had the biggest problems with aren't
they're Marvel not there anymore. Any,
yeah, because you know, Jemis has been gone for years. Quesada's just left, even though we think he's still involved in some form. I don't think he's not involved as much with the comic side of things. And so now you got Cebulski as editor in chief.
And Hickman, I think, took a lot of inspiration.
I think so. Yeah, I think you've had a lot more. I think you've had a lot more writers since then, because now it's been 20 years too. So I think a lot of the writers you're going to have coming in now are people who came up during the Morrison era. Mm-hmm. And that's going to have a lot of influence on, you know, what kind of stories are told. And I think there may be a time when they're able to convince, but I think too, it's Morrison's in a interesting place now, because you know, they're doing TV work now. Like, they're doing that Brave New World series. I think they're also doing an Invisibles adaptation as well, finally. So I wonder how much Morrison would want to play with some of these characters, because getting the sense from reading their, do you guys ever read Super Gods?
a long time ago, but yeah.
Yeah, reading that, like, I did get a definite sense that they were much more of a DC guy growing up than Marvel. And, like, I think if, you know, you go up to Morrison, and for the most part, I think they're in a stage of their life where they'd rather focus on their own stuff. Mm-hmm. But if they have the opportunity to do, with the exception of something like Superman or Batman. I don't know. That's just the way I read it. So I'm not sure if...
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's how Marvel was able to get Joss Whedon, right, to write Astonishing, because that's something that he would have been reading when he grew up and had like a real affinity for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's the only reason why they were able to pull in such a big name to a comic book title, especially coming off Buffy. And I'm pretty sure he finished with Astonishing before the Avengers came out, but the film anyway. But I think you're right. It would only be one of those sort of like childhood dream projects that he would go back, and Marvel probably doesn't hold that for him, for Morrison rather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for whatever it's worth, Morrison has more recent DC output, so there doesn't seem to be as much problem with them like right playing that sandbox than Marvel.
Right. Well, I mean, I think like the most recent thing they've done with DC is Superman and the Authority, and I've read people describe it as kind of like Morrison's farewell to company superhero books. So I'm not sure how much of that is accurate. I haven't seen any interviews with them that confirm that or anything, but I just saw people talking about that when the final issue of Superman and the Authority came out.
It makes sense. Like as a writer, you would be wanting to do your creator own work, right? You want to be in control of your creations, but also financially, you want to be able to be making bank from it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And, you know, speaking as a creator myself, you know, I love working on my own creations, but two, you get to a point when you don't want to keep doing the same stuff, right? Like I just finished up a series and that was the fifth book in a series. And I'm just like, okay, well, I'm done with that character. I don't really want to do anything more with him right now. Maybe that'll change a few years down the line. But if you ask me to do, also I'm in a much different financial place than Morrison is with my creations. But like, if you ask me to do any Marvel or DC book, I would jump at the chance. Like you could ask me to write, I don't know, fucking Squirrel Girl, and I'll figure out a way to do it. I've got nothing against Squirrel Girl. I just like, it's not a character that I'm really that interested in. So that's why I just pulled that out of my hat.
I seen a comment, and this is relevant. This is adjacent, but still relevant in terms of like getting creators to do work that they're done with. They're just saying like, I'm done with that. I put it aside. I seen some comments about Sex and the City and Kim Cattrall saying, I'm not coming back as Samantha Jones. I'm done with it. And someone said, you know, she's like, I don't want to do that work anymore. I don't like it. And someone said, well, I don't like working at the bank. Right. I don't like my job at the bank, but I've got to go to work. So just shut up and go to fucking work. Right. Like we want to see it. I think sometimes creators like that might get a little pressure to write things that they're over because there's a real hunger for it.
But there's something that sounds awful.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like as an office worker, like, okay, but like, I think there's a world of difference. There should be a world of difference between like something creative and say like,
there is, yeah, there
working
is.
It's in a bank, like it, I feel like that the work wouldn't be as good or as, I don't know, like,
well, I mean, also
pure is not a good word, but wouldn't be as pure if like you force Kim Cattrall, like you will play Samantha because we'll make you.
You will do what I say.
Oh, well, right. Oh my God. Like,
but I mean, yeah, think about some of the instances where people have come back, right? Like, you know, not only, I mean, Chris Claremont's the obvious one since we're an X-Men podcast that, you know, everyone was.
But I think he likes to come back. He wants to
come back. At this point, yeah,
he
wants to come back.
No one's making him come back.
Yeah, at this point, nobody's asking for Chris Claremont to come back, but he won't.
Well, no, I mean, that's not accurate.
That's true,
I'm sure some people
there
do.
There are some people, yeah. Yes. We're both on that House of X group. We've definitely seen posts of that nature.
The problem with Chris Claremont coming back is that when he did come back, he came back and just failed so spectacularly.
Yeah.
and I think, and look, I'm not disregarding any of his work. His work has changed my life and all of our lives because we're all X-Men fans. And, you know, he has earned his spot as somebody that deserves respect.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel it's a little bit like, I'm coming up with so many, it was Pride Month, so a lot of gay sort of references here, but it's a bit like Madonna, right? You love her original work, but the stuff that she's coming up with now, it's the day is gone, right? The stuff that he's doing now, it's just not, it doesn't fit in with the current readership of comics.
Mm-hmm.
It's too old.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, when Claremont was doing all that groundbreaking stuff, he was a young guy. He was tapped into what people were concerned about at the time. And now he's not. So, I mean,
it's an ingenue that had his finger on the pulse of the culture. Right. And now that's gone.
And it too, like, you know, you look at someone, you know, like Frank Miller, right? Frank Miller, when he was going to come back to do Dark Knight Returns, everybody freaked out. And then, I mean, The Dark Knight Strikes Again. And then it actually came out and everyone's like, what is this? and then he did, you know, All-Star Batman and Robin. And at that point, we're all just like, is this a bit? Are you doing a bit now? What is this?
Like, yeah, this doesn't feel the same as the other stuff did. Yeah.
And I wonder if, you know, if we say like, you know, we'd like to see Morrison come back. I don't think it would be that to those extremes, but I think there would definitely be a sense of, do they really kind of have that? Because something like New X-Men, it was like lightning in a bottle, right? Can Morrison really kind of capture that feel again? I'm not saying that they couldn't, but wondering if we would even want to see the attempt in case it would like fail.
I do think like that's, and that was the exact phrase I would have used to describe the run. But I don't think that would be a fair metric to judge it if they were to ever do it again. But I will say that out of all the status quo since they left, the current one feels the most custom fit to like Morrison's aesthetic
and sensibilities.
Sensibilities. Like, I can't think of an era that's more well suited to the kind of thing they might bring.
I mean, it would be interesting to see Morrison play around in this new kind of status quo, because I don't know. And I've kind of got the sense that, and I get the sense of this with a lot of Hickman stuff, is that I feel like he's got all these great big ideas, but I kind of feel like the characters get lost in the ideas. Whereas Morrison is much more able to balance those two.
Yeah. And you're right. Cause I read an interview where the intent with the current flagship title when Hickman took over was to have it be some kind of like idea incubator. So like he would do one shot and two shot stories that would then spin out to like other different series or things that are happening in other books, which is ultimately not how Marvel wanted to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
In a lot of ways, I think if you just read New X-Men and then hop on over to like the Krakoan era, like it works seamlessly. Like you don't need any of the other stuff in between, which is how much I think interconnected and how much inspiration Hickman took from that one in constructing this current era.
It's just a lot of inspiration from Morrison, but also Mike Carey's run as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, with the Children of the Vault.
Even more than that, the depiction of some of the characters seem very, like, I feel a big stamp of his.
Which is good, because I think we've all talked about how that, you know, we all love the Carey run and kind of wish that it would get more attention. So I think it's good that they're going back to that. And I feel like Carey's work got really overshadowed by the Fraction stuff that came after it. And, you know, I've read the Fraction stuff. It's okay, but I never understood why so many people held it up as some amazing feat of work. It felt like a step down after what Carey had done.
I mean, I really like Fraction stuff. They were both very good, but I think you're right. Like that, I think there's a certain sort of flashiness and showmanship with Fraction that I appreciate, that I think made it so that Carey's run felt a bit more underrated. But I thought they were both good.
Morrison's run really has been a touchstone in terms of like, I think like if you're talking about art, that you look at art history, there's like a timeline, and Morrison's mm-hmm. stamp on the X-Men's timeline is very sharp and hard and strong, especially considering that the book only ran for like 3 years?
Maybe a little over 3 years? I
think. 41 issues, so about, yeah, probably about 3 years or so with all the delays.
Mm-hmm. That is crazy. That's such a monumental impact for such a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone else has had that. Maybe Hickman.
Maybe,
yeah. I think, yeah, probably Hickman, mm-hmm. just because of all the... Hickman was in a unique place, though, because he was basically kind of guiding the line as well. Morrison wasn't, right? They were... Their book was setting, in a way, kind of setting the tone for the line, but... And it became the flagship book kind of by default because they were the biggest name on it at the time. And that was the one that was getting the most attention, but it wasn't quite the same as like Hickman, where Hickman is the guiding
showrunning.
Yeah, yeah. Showrunning it. Very, that's mm-hmm. the word I was looking for. Yes, exactly. So one other thing, this might be kind of the final thing we touch on, but knowing what we know now about what came after the Morrison run and for this thought experiment, Morrison is still leaving the book, right? But let's say you could change what had happened after Morrison left. Like, who do you think you would have wanted to pick up the baton after they left if you could kind of redo that period afterwards? Or what kind of ways do you think that the post-Morrison era could have been handled better?
Well, we definitely wouldn't have had those two issues of Chuck Austin.
Oh, Jesus Christ, yeah. No, Chuck Austin is getting fired right off the bat.
I mean,
oh,
boy. Let me just say that.
Oh, boy.
Definitely that, right? I would have said, I think they made him, I really liked the idea of having the core book, which New X-Men was with Morrison, and all of the other books picking up some of those threads, you know, like the characters going over to the Academy X and Genosha exploring Magneto or whatever. Like I think that was a good idea. I just think the execution of that idea was really bad. And I think the how long after Morrison left did it take for Whedon to start?
That was like right after.
Not too long. Maybe a few, not even a few months.
Yeah, yeah. Because Whedon's book was kind of like the flagship book of the Reload mm-hmm. era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you keep Whedon on? Would you have Whedon still come on?
I really enjoyed Astonishing X-Men. I don't have a lot of bad things. The only bad thing I have to say about Astonishing X-Men is I find the idea of alien civilizations not gelling really well with the X-Men and their philosophy. Yeah. So the whole Breakworld stuff, I was just like, ugh. And I also find it really boring when they bring characters back from the dead. And they were like the two big staples of his run, but the idea of the cure, super interesting. Let's explore that. Like Kitty Pryde, he made me like Kitty Pryde, which I'd never liked before. I was a Jubilee kid, so I don't want to say anything bad about Whedon's run. I think it was a good idea to have a superstar come on. They really needed a superstar to follow Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who else I would have picked. I've never. You've stumped me a little bit. I've never thought about it. What about you guys?
Pat?
I would still keep Whedon on because I really enjoyed Astonishing and I still enjoy rereading it nowadays. And I think that era I wasn't sort of as in tune into, like, I guess I was more of like a character focused rather than sort of being a more creator focused consumer of comics nowadays. So I'm not quite sure who I would slot in instead of who we got,
mm-hmm.
but I will say that I think it would have been cool to sort of, if not the entire line, but maybe have somebody be on a book that would work more in sort of pushing the boundaries that Morrison already kind of broke and pushed through, because I feel like the line after they left sort of reverted. It was some of it, most of it was still good and enjoyable, but I feel like it just reverted back to sort of conventional, really like conventional superhero fare. So I think it would have been fun and interesting to see some like out there creator come on, like maybe not the entire line, but sort of one book to further explore some of the concepts that Morrison introduced.
I think
I would have liked the, just sorry, I didn't mean to jump in there, but no, I would have liked to have an extension of the Black Leather X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit sad to think that that only lasted like 3 years. That deserved to last a lot longer.
Which I think I would. Sorry, go ahead, Pat. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, which is not to say we didn't get that, because I think one of the reasons that Morrison's run has had such an outsized impact, considering how long it lasted, is, yeah, like a lot of creators picked up a lot of characters and concepts from the run to this day.
I mean, I like the Astonishing run, but I don't think it fits as... Here's what I would do with the Astonishing run. I would make it an out of continuity book, right? I, you know, kind of like,
that's what it feels like.
It does really feel like it. That's, it's so it disconnected like from the rest of the line, with the exception of Colossus being resurrected and Kitty disappearing for several years. There's not really a whole lot that's felt outside of that book. It's so self-contained. And
like the I remember the reaction to House of M was like, I think Scott or Logan saying like, well, there's a few less students around.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a bigger deal than like, well, there's a few less students around. So anyway, it's all good.
Like, moving if you guys on, know about, so. I'm not sure how much you guys follow DC, but they've got their whole Black Label line where they've got a lot of these books that are like kind of like these out of continuity books. Mm-hmm. I feel like Astonishing definitely fits like that. It works very well as something that's kind of separate from the main continuity. And instead of tying up all those characters from Morrison's run in that one book, I would kind of just set that outside of continuity and then just do some other stuff in the continuity.
But then who would be the flagship?
I feel like
that's the question.
What would be the flagship? Like, would that be uncanny with the XSE?
No, I wouldn't have Claremont and Austin. Pat what I'm saying.
Pat jokingly says.
I feel like I don't like the out of continuity stuff. I think as it's cool for people like us that have, you know, a deep reading of the comic book lore, but for new readers, I find it really confusing. I remember when I first started reading, I was so confused about characters that weren't appearing in the TV show, or they weren't appearing in one. Like, can you imagine starting reading when the Ultimate line was out, and you're like, oh, okay, well, that's a different universe, and this is here, and that's, it's all just, I like it better when it's all together and it's all a bit more streamlined. I don't want any out of universe books.
I'm thinking to a lot of like DC stuff.
Unless
like, DC's done a lot
of
really
Exiles. The Exiles, that I don't mind that, because it's, you know,
well, cause like
out
said,
of universe, but it
I'm
is.
I'm thinking about how DC has done a lot of stuff like Dark Knight Returns or All-Star Superman or Superman Up, Up, and Away. And these are out of continuity books. They're not tied to any specific continuity. Or even if you want to take it to Marvel, think about like the Mutant Empire trilogy that Christopher Golden did, the novelizations. Those were also kind of like these out of continuity things, because they took kind of elements from current continuity, but there was other stuff in there too, because Magneto was a vegetable at the time. So, but he's a main driver in that story. And I don't know. I think, and Whedon stuff, it feels so out of continuity because it's so disconnected from everything else that, and I think if you want to continue on with the Morrison's feel, but still keep Whedon stuff, I think you have to separate it into its own thing.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying that's what I would do with that. And as for who I would have to write it, I mean, honestly, I keep coming back to Mike Carey. I mean, he wasn't a superstar creator or anything back then, but, oh, okay. Now this probably would have been impossible, but you know who I would have really liked to see pick up the ball after Morrison and seen what they could have done with it? Neil Gaiman.
Could you imagine?
I love Neil Gaiman. I don't think it would be a good fit. I could be wrong, but I don't know.
I would love to read that. And I think so many people would love to read Neil Gaiman's take on the X-Men.
But didn't we get that in 1602?
Not really, sort of, but not really.
Okay. I mean, if we're not restricted to that particular time and who's working, I mean, are we, Perry?
I was thinking that particular time, but why? What do you have in mind?
Like, I think it would. I want to see, and I know, like, he pitched or he was possibly being courted to sort of run the line after Secret Wars, but I want to see Rick Remender running the line and see what that looks like.
I mean, Remender had such, I don't know what happened, but he had such promise with that, with like his X-Force stuff, and then he went over to Uncanny Avengers, and then they just kind of like,
so I feel like editorial mandates had something to do with that. But
well, I mean, yeah, he seemed to leave Marvel pretty quickly after Axis, and then it's after just Axis, like gone.
But he seems to have a similar kind of sensibility and aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'd like to see maybe what he can do with maybe like some kind of one-off what if after.
Like, well, he also did a pretty good job with some of those concepts, like the world and that kind of stuff in X-Force. So yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
And I feel like he has that kind of quirkiness too. Mm-hmm. That is it, not exactly like Morrison's, but I think would be a good successor to like carry the concepts
through. Right. Also, I think David Hein, I think is his name, who was doing District X. He would have been an interesting choice too, because he had kind of that weirdness, or also Paul Cornell too, you know, bringing some more of that British sensibility.
I was going to say Mark Millar, but I'm like, oh yes.
I think that would have also been an even bigger middle finger to Morrison than what they did. Yeah.
Really?
Why is that?
Oh my God. He fucking hates Miller. They used to be like best friends. They did a lot of ghostwriting for Miller back in the day. Mm-hmm. And like, if you read some of Miller's early stuff, you're reading it, you're like, wow, this is really good. It's not like his current stuff. And that's probably because Grant Morrison was ghostwriting a lot of it.
But Miller's Ultimate X-Men was great.
Was it?
Your mileage may vary.
Have you reread that at all recently?
I haven't reread it recently, but that series started really well, I thought.
I really liked
Ultimate X-Men until Miller left. And when Miller left, that's when it got shit.
See, I loved it at the time, but then I reread it recently, and reading it as an adult reads much different than when you're reading it as a teenager or a college student. Okay.
The Ultimates was great. I'm going to do that.
It's been a while, but I have this feeling that if I read it right now, my reaction would be like, I guess this was cool, but now it just feels desperately edgelordy.
It does. It is what it is. It's so edgelord. It's like a teenager who, you know, who pierces his ear and starts wearing a leather jacket.
Is that the edgelord?
I don't know. It's like someone who's trying to be. It's like you guys ever see Superbad?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the McLovin character. Kind of like that guy trying to be a badass. That's what it feels like.
I mean, unconfirmed because I've yet to reread it, but I have a feeling like that would be my.
It will be. It's like you read it, and I remember a review. I think I may have mentioned this before, but the X-Axis, there was a review site back in the day, and they did a review of Ultimate X-Men number 6, and I'll never forget this line because I think it's the perfect summation of Miller's work, and he said that I'm tired of this adolescent exercise in dick waving.
The X-Axis is a very good review site, actually. I really enjoy his stuff. Yeah. I think he's British as well.
I think, yeah, definitely. he's definitely got that British snarkiness, at least. He Morrison and Miller don't get along. I think Morrison had said of Miller, he was asked why they had fallen out, and Morrison was kind of cagey about it, but they had said that, you know, basically Miller destroyed my faith in fucking humanity. And he says it, and they said that if I was driving a car and I hit Mark Miller, I wouldn't stop.
Oh dear.
That's so harsh.
Yeah.
Okay, then.
Especially about someone you know.
Which, and you guys have seen how Morrison talks about most other people. They don't talk like that. So to talk like that about Miller is pretty strong.
Yeah, I think it's pretty strong to talk about anyone like that. That's a very, very, very harsh language, especially for someone who their career is language. I'm very surprised by that.
Like that's it shows you that that's how that, like, that's how much like Miller had crossed them, basically.
I would say that about someone that's like slept with my wife or something, you know, like that's very they're fighting words.
Yeah, absolutely.
So no collaboration between those two.
No, definitely not.
Well, I enjoyed Miller's stuff. I'm definitely going to give it a reread now after this bashing of Miller that we've heard. Like a teenager who pierces his ears and wears a leather jacket. My 14-year-old self is like crying inside.
Well, I mean, which makes sense because that I feel like that is the demo that would enjoy
that he's going for.
Yes.
Fair.
No, but I mean, like making Wanda and Pietro like incestuous on like I mean, how much more edgelordy can one get?
I like that he did that though. I'm pushing back a lot today, but I actually I like that he did that, and you know what? Okay. I really liked the Game of Thrones incestuous stuff. Like, it is controversial. It is edgy, and it does make me question within myself and my own values as to whether I would treat two consenting adults that are brother and sister in a relationship in a detrimental way or a prejudice way. Because really, if as long as they're not having children, whose business is it really? That's big questions. That's worth exploring. I honestly don't think it happens in real life, though.
The exploring or the not having children?
I'm not sure if you're being...
I don't think there are brothers and sisters. I don't think they're... I am being serious. I don't think in real life there are brothers and sisters that are having relationships like that. I honestly don't think that that is real. So it's all just, you know, imaginary. Everyone's gone very quiet. Did you guys not like those storylines in Game of Thrones?
I mean, I haven't really paid much attention to Game of Thrones, actually, so.
I mean, I feel like it works in that context, but like in the Ultimates, I feel like that choice was made without any like purpose or intention or any like notion about like, oh, exploring what does this mean, or like having the same kind of self-reflectiveness that you just demonstrated right now, Oscar. Like, it was more just like, it is the edgy thing
exactly
to do,
yeah,
and
yeah,
I'm gonna do it. Like, there wasn't really a lot of like self-reflection either on the part of the characters or the other characters' reaction to what was going on with them. It was mostly played for like, ooh, there's that kinky thing they're doing, and we're gonna like we're just gonna be titillated by it, but also repulsed, but also titillated.
Yeah. Look, I'm not disagreeing. I'm definitely open to rereading it to see whether through new eyes it's as not as good as I remember, and I hope that that's not the case, because I did really enjoy it when it came out.
Yeah, I feel like as Miller moved away from Morrison, he started just leaning heavily into the edgelord stuff, and because Morrison wasn't ghostwriting stuff for him and giving him ideas anymore.
I've never heard the term edgelord before. I've learned something new today.
You never heard that term before?
No, never.
I feel like Miller's output since is it no Kick-Ass, you know, mm-hmm. Kick-Ass and Wanted, like,
yeah,
I feel like everything he's done since then are basically remixes of yeah. those two stories. Like,
well, I mean, and
those two stories are great.
I mean, I read Wanted, and I just felt like it was Miller just giving me the finger the whole time.
Yeah, kind of, but
I felt it was kind of like Miller saying, like, I can't believe you're reading this shitty thing I wrote.
But everything else,
you can give me money for this.
But everything else since then, I felt like it's like some retweak of that same concept.
I mean, I never read Kick-Ass, but after I read Wanted, that was mm-hmm. after Wanted and Civil War, that was just kind of like, oh, I'm out, I'm done with Miller. After
yeah, Civil War, I was like, it was a bit shit, but I did like the theory of having, you know, a political issue and some being obviously Republican and some being obviously Democrat and having them tussle out. And I really liked in Civil War that you had one side that was a clear winner. And I liked that. You don't, I think often when you have like these two superhero teams come up, it's always a draw. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed that there was one winner in Civil War, but that's the only kind of nice thing I've got to say about it. And the art was good.
Yeah, the art was great. Yeah. But yeah. And then when I saw the Wanted movie and, you know, I'm just kind of like, I like Miller's ideas better when someone else is interpreting them. Like, I thought the Wanted movie was so much better than the comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's partly because they basically just took the very basic idea and just threw everything else out.
Yeah, they got rid of a few of the more like outlandish stuff, mm-hmm. right? And, yeah. and sort of pared it right down. And that made it, it kind of worked. The only thing I can really remember from the film is the guns, like them, like using the guns like whips, kind
yeah,
of, and the bullets spinning around.
Yep.
And Angelina Jolie, who is just magnetic in pretty much everything that she's in,
and an early James McAvoy in that too.
Indeed.
Yeah, you're right, actually.
And was it Chris Pratt in that movie? As
was
well?
He? I didn't realize that.
Wasn't he?
I don't remember. I don't remember him in that. I'll have to look that up later.
Yep, he was.
Oh, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll have to look that up again. I did not realize he was in that movie.
I think he played the office bully that was.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Life
okay.
Horrible.
That makes sense. Okay. All right. So I think now we've digressed and this is starting to become a Mark Miller podcast.
Which I'm sure Morrison would be very happy with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Fuck Mark Miller. That there.
Oh boy.
Put it back
there you go.
But this is the last episode. So any final things you wanted to say about the Morrison run?
This podcast has really shocked me in the fact that it only went for 3 years. Mm-hmm. It made such a big impact on the X-Men, and in my brain, I thought it was much bigger than what it actually was. And I wish we had more of it. I really wish we had more of it. I've read not a lot of other Morrison stuff, but I did really, really, really enjoy We Three.
Yes.
And I would encourage everybody that hasn't read that to really go out and get it, because it's only 3 issues, but it's quite Lee and Morrison together again at their, the magic is there to see and soak up.
You haven't read much more of Morrison stuff than that?
I really haven't. I've read a few of the start of the All-Star Superman. Yeah, I've read a little bit of that, and that's it.
Well, rather than rereading Mark Millar, I think you should read his Justice League run.
Yes,
the Justice League run.
I'm such a Marvel boy, though. I really am a Marvel. I know.
His JLA run is excellent. Amazing. Like it's basically it's peak superhero comics. Like it's just like totally just. You know when they talk about the whole idea of widescreen superheroes and they attribute a lot of it to Warren Ellis? I say, no. Grant Morrison did that with JLA before Ellis did anything with it.
Have you read his... Now we're just going to recommend Morrison.
Yeah. I think it's a good way to end.
I think it's a very good way to end.
Perfect. The Batman run where Damian Wayne is introduced.
Run, yeah.
Yes. And what is the... it's not All-Star, Batman Inc. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Batman Incorporated.
Batman Incorporated. Yeah. Yeah. So like the Batman run followed by Batman Inc. I think.
It's interesting too, because Batman Incorporated, and I was listening to buddy of mine, Anthony Desiato. He used to have this podcast called My Comic Shop Book Club, and they had talked about the new X-Men stuff just kind of like did an overview of it in two episodes. But the guest he had on, I can't remember the guy's name at the time, at this moment, but he had mentioned that Morrison's idea kind of the corporation as a superhero. And you look back at what Batman Incorporated was, and that's connected to what Morrison started to do in New X-Men with the X Corporation. But even further back than that, like in Marvel Boy, like if you guys ever read that, there was a lot of that kind of stuff in there too. So it is interesting to see how Batman Incorporated connects to New X-Men and Marvel Boy in that way.
And like maybe my last recommend, like Multiversity.
Multiversity was good too.
Yes.
I will recommend, if you want to go weird, if you want Morrison at their weirdest, then you want to check out Doom Patrol and you want to check out The Invisibles. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, but here's,
did like, he do Animal Man as well?
Yes, they did Animal Man too. So
I've read the one issue of Animal Man where Animal Man starts talking to the reader and breaking the fourth wall. I have read that.
Oh, I was going to say like this, and I love that this is kind of a deep cut, I think. But speaking of the Mark Millar connection, Skrull Kill Crew.
Yeah. Y'all. And that's recently been re-released. It's in print again too. So
yes, yeah. Check that out. It's great. If nothing, just for the, I think they both wrote that, right, Perry?
Yes, yeah. They
I think they're both credited. Yeah, they co-wrote that together. It might be an interesting read.
One thing I'll say too, and I'm not sure what the hell's going on with this, what the rights situation is, but you know, if someone's reading this who has some access to the rights, put Zenith back into print, because that was this early superhero comic that they did. And I'm really curious. I've never read it, but I'm really curious to read it. And I hope that gets collected in some form in the near future. It looks like I just double checked on Amazon. It looks like it is in print in like four big volumes. So that's something else to check out. It's you want a deep cut. That's a deep cut.
I think I'm going to start with JLA.
Start with JLA. JLA is a good
place to start.
Yeah, it's a good place to start. It's very Morrison uses some of their big ideas are in there, but they're a lot more subtler. Whereas if you get into something like Doom Patrol or Invisibles, the ideas are right in your face, right? They don't try to hold your hand at all in those books. But in JLA, and this is one of the things I like about Morrison, is they really kind of know what audiences they're writing for. And with JLA, they took a much more mainstream approach. And some of the most interesting things that was being done with those characters at the time was being done in JLA. Like that was the time during Morrison's run, that was when they changed Superman's powers and they gave him those electric powers. I'm not sure if you remember this, but the only writer who did anything interesting with those powers was Morrison. Like in the Superman books, they did nothing interesting with them. So yeah, definitely check that out. I've heard good things about Superman and the Authority, but I haven't read that yet.
I've enjoyed it a lot, although the feeling I got was this feels like a pilot episode that was created for somebody to swoop in and take over.
Oh, okay.
Like it was a good introduction, but I felt like, yeah, like it was a pilot essentially.
Okay. But yeah, I think that about brings us to the end. Like, you know, definitely check out some of Morrison's other stuff, especially their creator owned work, because that's, a lot of that stuff needs a lot more. They've even done some really small things, like Sebastian Oh was really good. The Mystery Play. These are some really good small things that they did. What's
that series with Fraser Irving? Did you read that one?
I'm not sure. I'm checking right now. Annihilator?
Yeah, that one. I've
never
even
heard of this. I'll have to look into this. It's
pretty good.
Oh, that looks interesting. Yeah, I'll have to check that out. Okay. All right. So I think that about does it. Guys, you want to tell people where they can find you?
You can see my ramblings on Twitter at ODAT220.
You can catch me on Tumblr at Perfect Fabric Day Killing Machine and my other X-Men related podcast, Krakoan Exports. We're in a bit of a hiatus right now, but we're busy creating episodes for, I guess, what we're calling season two. So check that out wherever you find podcasts.
Nice. And my other podcast, Superhero Cinephiles, superherocinephiles.com, where we talk about superhero movies. And both of these guys have been on it. Both of them came on to talk about Generation X. Pat came on solo to talk about The Eternals. And there's also now a book club component, companion podcast for Patreon subscribers, where I'm going to be talking about different graphic novels I read. And I'm going to put these guys on the spot and, you know, see, let them know that there's an open invitation if they ever want to come on to that.
Yeah, so speaking of Perry, I'm a little bit irked that you did not invite me for your Hellfire Gala episode.
I just had to get something out to get it
I
out.
Will. Perhaps we can, you can redo it with me.
We can go back and revisit that.
Perhaps, yeah. Indeed.
Right. Well, there's going to be a second Hellfire Gala coming
That's
up very
true.
Soon.
There we go.
Right?
Yeah.
They're
true.
Announcing
That's
the new
true.
Team. So
indeed, indeed.
And I still haven't, you know, and there's a, you know, I've only gotten up to Hellfire Gala is as far as I've read in the Hickman stuff. And that's the only book I've actually covered. So there's a lot of other trades that we could talk about with that.
Of course.
So
I find it so crazy that you're able to withhold from reading the new stuff as it comes out.
Well, it's
like,
you know,
that's
why,
such
you know why
good,
I did it.
I,
you know why I did it? Because it was,
yeah,
it became a pain in the ass because I'd gone back and I'd been away from reading comics regularly when I moved to Japan, and then I'd gotten back into it with Comixology, but I was reading so many books and it was costing so much money every month, and when I'd get to a new issue, I'd forget what would happen in the previous issue, and it just kept frustrating me. And so finally I decided, with all these sales they got on Comixology, it's much easier to just wait for the trade and get the whole story in one package.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of wait for the trades, but I just don't have the patience. It's not within me, and I don't like things being spoiled, so I can't help it. The only thing I'm reading in trade form at the moment actually is Saga.
I've got the first few trades of that, and see, that's another thing too, is I've got such a big to read pile that I've got so much stuff that I still have to read. So
Saga is one of
the current stuff.
Saga is one of the best series I've ever read, and now that it's started up again, I go to read one issue and I'm like the same thing. I'm like, what happened last issue? Like,
right.
I need to read it in trade format. So that's one I'm going to leave, but that's very specific series.
Mm-hmm. But okay. Yeah. So superherocinephiles.com and also percivalconstantine.com for all my other writings and artwork and all that kind of stuff can be found there. And that does it for this series, guys. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this, for coming on this journey with me. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
It has been a lot of fun. I really enjoyed being able to nerd out with you guys and also go back and reread. What a great series to do it to.
Yeah, I really always enjoy reading the series, and I think going on this podcast has made me see some aspects of it in new light. So yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, this is also made me want to go back and reread some other Morrison stuff. So I'm probably going to eventually do another reread of The Invisibles and JLA too after doing this.
Okay,
guys, thanks again. Thanks everyone who's listening. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this. If you want to send us any comments, you know, please do so. E4Evolution at gmail.com or also Morrison XPod on Twitter or Instagram. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you wherever we pop up next. E for Evolution, examining Grant Morrison's X-Men, is produced by Percival Constantine with theme music by Aaron Kenny. Audio of Grant Morrison and Stan Lee was recorded at San Diego Comic-Con 2008 and provided by bravogabo.livejournal.com. You can find E for Evolution on Twitter and Instagram at MorrisonXPod and on the web at eforevolution.transistor.fm. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is eforevolutionpodcast@gmail.com. Support the show by leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts, which helps us reach more listeners. Special thanks to the members of the House of X Facebook group for their encouragement in getting this show started.